It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 429. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for future show topics. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. The phone number is 240-949-2450. And that's Mike Tech Show, all one word, on Skype. And I have the one voicemail that I'm going to play early in the show that's got a really great question. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Mike Tech Show. Follow me on Facebook, facebook.com/Mike Tech Show. And don't forget the wiki, MTS Wiki, that's wiki.com. There you'll find links to all my past shows and information on the software and hardware that I use for my studio setup. I have, again, jam-packed show, and I have the voicemail, email. Now, the email, a couple questions on business regulations and compliance. So we're going to talk about that and how I got started in that, where I don't know if that'll help you. Well, I hope it does. Right now, as we get started, before I went away last week, I received a call from a listener who's a consultant who needed help with a server and announcing servers, announcing workstations to the server. Well, this was easy. Instant house call. Because instant house call, I was able to not only have the three workstations being remoted into, but also the server. At the same time, I was able to show the client exactly how to announce a workstation to the server. Because this was his first experience with Server 2008, and he had Windows 7 desktops, and it was so easy. I had him go to the website that I have, which is miketechshow.instanthousecall.com. You will get your own website landing page that you can give out to clients. So then they download the client. They just click connect to specialist. And in seconds, you are remote controlling their desktop. And you're now collaborating with that user. There are a great tool set that you would like. How about recording the whole session, saving it locally as an AVI, and you can send it to your client later to review. Almost like a tutorial of everything that you've done. Great features like that. And right now, you can start providing remote support for your customers today with Instant House Call. It's easy for your customers and powerful for your business. And right now, Mike Tech Show listeners can try it free for 15 days. Click on the link on my website or just go to instanthousecall.com, download the free trial, and don't forget to enter the promo code Mike Tech Show. A quick tip of something that I was able to solve today for a client. RDP is still used for remote access for people. And I know there's so many other things for remote access. But RDP, they have the TCP/IP listening port, which is defaulted to 3389. They already have their router set to go to 3390, 3391. They just got new computers. And we changed the listening port, but RDP wasn't working. It was forwarding to the static IP address that we had assigned, but they weren't getting in. Turned off the firewall, they got right in. Had the firewall on with the exception for RDP, couldn't get in. Well, here's what the solution is. And it's just one other step that, in case you forget. Well, since the default port is 3389, if we change the listening port, you have to change the firewall rule of the local machine and set up a rule to allow port 3390 or 3391, whatever port you assigned. Something that got past us, it didn't take long. We finally figured it out. And then once we created the rule for that exception to allow our TCP/IP connections on that port, remote access was working. Just something I wanted to share. Now, I have a question that I want to put out there to anybody that's consulting or your businesses or maybe your own business or small business that you're working for. A business phone system that's voice over IP, that's cloud-based PBX. So the phone system's in the cloud with a handset that's purely TCP/IP. I need some recommendations. I'm going to throw two of them out there that I have clients that are using this because they pick this on their own. And one of them is Access Line. And I have one client that's happy, but they've only been using it for 2 weeks. And I have another client using RingCentral. And they're happy with that. And I haven't had a chance to like dig deep into these solutions except for I have these clients that they're very happy with those systems. What do you recommend? If you could take a moment, put an email together, maybe even record an MP3 or leave me a voicemail message and let me know some of your experiences with cloud-based PBX system for a small business. Because I'm getting more and more questions about this as I go over clients or give you an example. I have a client that's moving from one office to another and they're taking that opportunity to change the phone system, to change the server, to consolidate. Let me know what you think and we can discuss that and I will mention it on another show. I'll follow up with this. Here is the voicemail I was referencing. Give a listen and then I will respond.
Hi, Mike. I'm a longtime listener, and I'm also a supporter of your Amazon link. Much of the tech equipment I purchased for the company I work for comes from your Amazon link. I'm considering another purchase, and I wanted your input. It seems as if I remember that you recently acquired a Sling box, and I'm considering the purchase of one as well. I have a specific itch that I'm trying to scratch with this. A few months ago, I canceled my cable TV service in favor of internet only because most of what we watch is streaming video like Netflix or Hulu. Realistically, there was only about one news channel that I like to watch, and I can't find any way of getting that channel except to subscribe to a package of channels that my cable company provides. So essentially, I'd be paid about $45 a month to watch one channel. So somehow soon, I think that cable companies are going to have to change with the times and offer channels on an a la carte basis, or the media providers are going to have to offer their product as a subscription available through Roku or some other streaming media players. So here's my idea. I have a sister in another state who's willing to help me with this. She has a cable and internet connection, and I would like to purchase a Sling box and have it sent to her home and have her hook it up. My idea is to purchase a Boxy box or a WBTV or a Google TV, which all appear to support the Sling box app. It appears that I could watch this one channel through this device as streamed content from her home. And when I had cable TV, I always liked to watch this news channel in the morning as an alarm, in the evening while getting ready for bed. And I would hope that one of these devices would allow me to start and stop the app on a schedule so that I would not be streaming all the time. My sister and I like to experiment with new technology, and if this works, I could easily pay for the cost of the equipment for what the cost of a cable TV channel bundle would cost me over a few short months. I could probably find this out on the Slingbox FAQ section or call them, but I don't think I've heard this content covered on your show, and I thought it might be interesting. So I have a few questions based on your experience with the Slingbox. My first one is, does your Slingbox appliance use much bandwidth when you're watching content remotely? And the second is, if I was watching content remotely, would it prevent my sister from watching something else? And the third is, would the Slingbox allow two different streams so that if I were watching my news channel but my sister was traveling, and wanted to watch something else, would we both be able to watch content at the same time? And number four, have you had any experience using one of the companion boxes like Boxy with your Slingbox? And my last one is, in general, do you think this would be a workable situation at all? Thanks.
Great question, and I do think it's workable, but there are some limits. I have my Slingbox connected to one of my Verizon boxes that's at a TV that's only used for gaming. My youngest son has his Xbox connected to that TV, and it's very seldomly used to watch TV. So I have full access to the content with that Slingbox connected. Now, from you ask a bunch of questions, and I'll try to remember them all. The first, from a bandwidth issue, I have a 35 meg down, 35 meg up. So I have large bandwidth, so I've never ran into a problem with bandwidth where everybody in the family is using the internet, my son's online gaming with the Xbox, and I have remotely connected to the Slingbox, and it has worked good. Your limitation is probably not going to be the home bandwidth, but the bandwidth of where you're at. If you're at a hotel with Wi-Fi that's very limited, has a terrible uplink connection, and then you try to go view your Slingbox, guess what? I've noticed choppy video, all kinds of problems. But in my own house, on my own network, in another room, it plays great. Now you're like, well, why would you do that? Well, it enables a second TV almost in a room that you don't have a second TV. Couple things, though. When you change the channel on a Slingbox, let's say you do have that Slingbox remotely at your sister or family member with their cable provider, they will have to watch what you're watching. You cannot have multiple channels, and you cannot have multiple people use the account at the same time. I can only log in one instance with my account because it can only stream the content that is on. So you literally get a remote control on the browser client. It's very nice, where I literally see my real Verizon remote control comes up as a pop-up. And when I change the channel, it's changing it on that box for Verizon. Or if it was Comcast, that cable box is the channel's changing. So if someone was watching the TV that the Slingbox is connected and you log in and change the channel, well, it's going to change in front of them. So knowing all of that, does it still work? I think it does. I still think it's worth just having a box. Let's say your sister has the cable box, put it in a room where with an Ethernet connection to the router, that cable box and the Slingbox, and don't even hook a TV to it and just let it go just for the Slingbox. A great example of this, I remember Todd talking about this a while ago, the host of Geek News Central podcast. His wife is from Japan, and she wants the Japanese content, and they have a Slingbox at her parents' house in Japan, and she can watch her content from Japan from just a browser. So there are lots of reasons to, and lots of ways to work it, but you really have to dedicate a separate box. Now, in answer to the question of Roku and Boxy, I have a Western Digital Live Hub, and the plugin for Slingbox works great. So if that Slingbox was at another location, I would have no problem. Now, of course, I'm seeing it on my own network. My common use for it is I'll bring up a browser, let's say when there's multiple sporting events at the same time. Now, unfortunately, my Phillies are not in the playoffs, but typically in October, there would be, let's say, a Phillies game and maybe an Eagles game on a Sunday for football. Well, on the main TV beside me, I would have one of the events, and then I will access the Slingbox from the other room on the browser on one of my screens on the computer and bring up the other event. So I'm literally watching two televised events, utilizing a box that's in a complete other room of the house. I love the sling box, but you have to work within those limitations. As long as someone has broadband, where that box is going to go, you're not going to have a bandwidth issue. And as long as you're accessing it from a broadband connection, you're not going to have any bandwidth problems. The problem's going to be if while you're watching a channel, someone else can't be unless they have that isolated like I talked about. Now, can these apps auto start? I don't believe the Slingbox app on the Western Digital Live Hub will work where it'll come on at a certain time. I believe you could rig a computer to do that with your browser, where you could have it start up and maybe log in using an automated, like auto hotkeys or something, and you could do that on a computer or a laptop. But I don't think the apps, at least on the Western Digital box, are sophisticated enough to do what you want as a timer. Let me know how you make out and if you're going to leverage the Slingbox or not. And I want to thank you. He mentioned using my Amazon link. I really appreciate that. And that's amazon.mikenation.net or miketechshow.com/Amazon. I thank everybody for continuing to use those links and supporting the Mike Tech Show. That's a great way to support the show. Your price is the same, but I get a commission for everything that you purchase from Amazon. So let's get to some email. This is in response to some questions from the last couple shows. And this is from Yitz from Israel. He says, regarding the Microsoft program that gives away software development tools for free, you can find it here. And that's dreamspark.com. I had a link last week for that. For web development startups, there is a sister program found here, and that's microsoft.com/web/websitepark. So websites park. Then to follow up on the topic, using your own domain for URL shortening, Google offers via the Google Apps Marketplace a URL shortener for the Google Apps domains. And he has a link. So those three links will be in the show notes. Thank you very much. This is from Zrinko. Mike, first off, I'd like to thank you for the quality show, which I consider to be a great service to the IT community. I believe the show especially benefits to the one-man operation as it provides a sense of sharing and camaraderie. Anyway, I have to chime in regarding a question and a comment on show number 426. First, the comment regarding the Microsoft partner website is right on. I have been a registered partner and an ActionPack subscriber for over 7 years and often struggle finding the information on the site, navigating it, or doing simple things like renewing my subscription. At times, I've had to resort to contacting support. In their defense, I quickly got step-by-step directions on how to do something. The point is, it should not be that hard. Oh, I agree. Now, to what I consider to be a main difference between the TechNet and ActionPack subscriptions. TechNet is for evaluating testing purposes only, while ActionPack license allows for internal use within your company, not for resale. TechNet provides access to all Microsoft software in download form, while the ActionPack only includes the latest version. For example, TechNet allows you to download Windows 95 or Office 2000, while ActionPack only includes Windows 7 or 8 and Office 2010. By the way, TechNet is the answer to the caller's question on how to legally obtain media for all different versions of Windows or Office. Hope this helps. Thank you for that. This is from Jim. In show 427, you responded to a listener who asked if he should sell a router to a customer who is connecting his computer directly to a modem. I completely agree with you that there needs to be a NAT in place and that a user should never connect directly to the internet. However, a tech cannot assume that just because the user is connected directly to the modem, that the user is connecting directly to the internet. I actually remember a client that has this very scenario. This is good email. I have most of my broadband experience with AT&T, who I use in many of the fast food locations that I support. Until recently, AT&T had three modems available. A Siemens modem, which was hard-coded to be in transparent bridge and thus needing a router. Various two-wire models, which were hard-coded with NAT, which I could not use in my locations because of the VPNs require the NAT to exist on the router, and the various Motorola models, which are highly configurable and by far the most flexible. I have the model 3347 in my home, and for what my wife and I need, it suits our needs just fine. It is a modem router and has a four-port switch built in and has a wireless access point built in. Well, that is a router. So, yes, he wouldn't need that. He wouldn't need another router on top of that. There are too many things to configure in this modem to list, but I can turn NAT on or off, turn DHCP on or off, or configure any IP scheme with whatever size of subnet that I want. Now, most customers will not have this type of modem, but many AT&T customers in this area probably still have the two-wire modem, which will still have NAT hard-coded in the modem. The tech does not need to access the modem to determine it has NAT capability. All the tech has to do is find out the IP of the computer on the network. As you know, if the IP is 10 or 172.16 through 172.32 or 192.168, these are non-routable IP addresses, by the way, then the computer most likely received an address from a DHCP server that is inside the modem. The tech can determine this either by running ipconfig at the command prompt or by access the details of the network adapter. I always type ipchicken.com, and that tells you your public IP address. So that's a great way to find out what the public IP address, that public-facing IP that you're being given, and compare that to your IP config so you know what you're being given internally. If the tech is curious about what the public IP, the tech can simply open a web browser and go do a Google search for what is my IP. The public IP will show up on the search results page. All these steps will take less time than what it would take me to write this for you to read it. I'm guessing that the scenario is not the more common setup that a tech will see. Still, by following the above simple steps, the tech can be confident in whether a recommendation is given to the customer is good. I look forward to future shows. Thanks for all you do. You are absolutely correct. And it's something that I did overlook in talking about when I received this question, where the tech asked me, what does he do when he doesn't want that customer-facing modem to just get an IP address? And he's right. There could be some NAT happening internal to that network, given there's so many providers. So if you're getting a public IP address on your network adapter, I think everybody agrees you should buy a router and have NAT. But if you're getting a non-routable IP address for your local IP on the network adapter, there's a good chance that there's NAT, there's some routing, there's some firewall protection from within the ISP. And if that's the case, you don't have to get a firewall or get a NAT router. I like to be in control of my own destiny. I would like to put it in there, but you don't have to. So very good email, and thank you, Jim, for that info. This is from Darren. Just listening to your latest show with regards to TrueCrypt forcing you to burn, then validate the ISO image while encrypting. I recently ran into the same problem and found that if you start TrueCrypt from the command prompt and place either the slash N or slash no ISO check, TrueCrypt will save the ISO image and let you continue. Hope this helps. That is awesome. I never used a command line prompt with TrueCrypt. That is only if you do not have a CD burner connected to your machine. So thank you. This is from Patrick, and a very surprising link here. It's the most dangerous websites are not porn sites. And this is from Tech News Daily. There's an article that Patrick sent me this link that blogs represent 19.8% of infections, web hosting 15.6%, business and economy 10%, 10th on the list at just 2.4% is pornography. That is very surprising. That's just kind of interesting. Thanks, Patrick, for passing that on. Now, I got two questions here that's going to lead into the really, I guess, the rest of the show for a discussion. And this involves around small business regulations. And this is from Chris. And he says, my question is, can you do a show dedicated on the regulations the major type of that a business have? I know the medical and banking fields have certain regulations that must be followed. If you do a show on this topic, where can someone find this? If you can't do a show, where can someone find information on this? Then I received another question on compliance. How did you learn to become compliant? HIPAA, etc. Did you take classes or read certain books? Please advise. And this is from Gabe. I am going to describe how I started and really when did this begin. And the best way to start this, I worked a long time ago for a manufacturing company. They manufactured high precision glass components for guidance systems, for heat-seeking missiles, and we were a big defense contractor, or I'd say a little company, but supplied lots of important pieces for guidance systems. This going way back to the early 90s, when this company wanted to become what they call ISO 9000 certified. That was a certification for manufacturers that showed that they follow specific procedures and they follow a certain guidelines to particular quality standards of manufacturing, that if you said you were ISO 9000 or then it became ISO 9001 certified, that got you a leg up with other clients who want to purchase your product. And especially if you were a government contractor, it was very important to be ISO 9000 certified. Well, one of the things that was important was building the documentation and the procedures, the manuals for the whole operation. The president of the company sent me, and I was the data processing manager, and one of my data entry operators, who, by the way, years later, becomes my senior network engineer. Well, the two of us go away for a week to just learn how to write manuals. Now, it didn't matter what it was for. It was very generic training on how to organize a manual, how to put documentation together on how to communicate steps, and how to document and properly build a manual. So I now have experience in writing manuals. And so does one of my employees. We're going to fast forward a little bit. And now I'm working for a large distribution company. It's a $2 billion company. And I was there for 12 years as the network manager. During this time, Enron happens. And a very big compliance in 2002 comes about, and it's called Sarbanes Oxley Act of 2002. Sarbanes-Oxley was a way for these two senators, really, Sarbanes and Oxley, to try to put together standards to make sure that the accurate financial reporting can happen and that the CFO would be held criminally liable if they sign off on their financial statements and they're not correct. So a way to guarantee this was 11 steps on how to make sure that you are accurately reporting. Well, this act put a great burden on large corporations that have to guarantee the accurate reporting of their financials. So that means security guidelines, there's procedures, there's a list of, you have to make sure you have firewalls in place, that there's regularly checking of the logs, on and on. And it was subject to interpretation. And you would use companies like PricewaterhouseCoopers to help you become compliant. Now, naturally, a large burden of that compliance fell on my shoulders and my senior network engineer, because we happen to have some great experience in building manuals. Now, my department already had great network documentation, just because that's me and that's the way it had to be. So we were halfway there. So becoming SOX compliant just meant there was just some maybe additional work or additional checks and balances, sheets at the end of different problems that they were signed off on, that the right management, you know, we didn't have a log when someone would enter the data center. Now there has to be a log. Anybody entering, they got to sign in. We went through a lot of work. We had some consultants that helped us with other areas of the business. But from the IT, when we were audited, I am very proud to say I was one of the few organizations that's a $2 billion company where our IT department received 100%. They couldn't find anything wrong with the compliance. So that's just because of my attention to detail and making sure that we followed the rules. And here's how you learn. And here's what you do. You say you're going to do something, and then you make sure that you prove that you do it. Great example is backups. It didn't matter what we were doing for the details of the backup, just the fact that if we said we're backing up all of our servers every night, that we have a checks and balances, that we do it, and that we record that we back up, and that we have a resolution process in place if a backup failed. We say that this is the process, and then we prove that we do that process. That's all Sarbanes-Oxley is. And so we did very, very well making sure that all this is happening. So I had incredible experience with Sarbanes-Oxley. Now remember, I already had the ISO 9000 certification. So let's fast forward just a little bit from that moment. When I'm consulting on my own while I was working full time, I come across a financial advisor that was handed to me to help him get connected to the corporate office for their VPN. And there was this little orange book that was supplied to this advisor with all the instructions. There were several consultants that didn't follow those instructions and couldn't get them connected. All I did was read the book. And I followed those instructions and I got him connected. As a matter of fact, I got him connected in like 15 minutes. There was just no router rules, and those router rules, I had to do it. Well, along the way, I don't realize this, but this financial advisor at the time was so happy, he starts spreading the word about me, and I start getting a nice little cottage business going with some excess work, you know, extra work on some nights and weekends. So now let's fast forward to 2008. Along the way, when I got laid off in that October, that was 4 years ago, I already had some of these financial advisors as clients. So the question is, could I make it as a full-time business? But what I learned by working with these financial advisors was just following the rules from the corporate company that very specifically make sure that they are FINRA compliant. And that is the financial industry. For FINRA compliance, I learned just by working with these people and the systems, all of their email has to be archived or journaled. There has to be a duplicate email. Winston knows this because he helped me with one of my largest clients a couple of years ago. And one of the big problems at the end of the project was getting that journaling to work. And that's because they were a client that fell under FINRA compliance. And we had to make sure that the exchange server was continuing to journal their email. Every message coming in and out was being journalized off-site at another organization. And we went through, oh, it was insane. And it wasn't our fault, as Winston just put in the chat. It was, I'm not going to dime them out, but the company it was on that we used for that journaling, it was their fault. Well, how do I learn about this? I just learned from experience. One of the other things, a great example, and I've often talked about this hard drive encryption that this parent company pushes down to these financial advisors. Well, now I have a company that's independent in that field of financial advising, but I'm now supplying new computers. What do I make sure? That all their drives are hard drive, the whole disk encrypted, and we use TrueCrypt, and we use the YubiKeys to just go even one step further. We make sure that the server is secured. Here's what you're going to find with a client. They will have the information in front of them that they have to follow to be compliant. What you have to do is take that, and that's all I did was I took the compliance forms from my client, read them, and interpreted solutions that we could implement so they followed the rules. A great example, all email has to be duplicated and journalized. Okay, we find a company that we can do that. All systems have to be encrypted. Okay, we find TrueCrypt. All systems, you cannot use an unencrypted USB key. Okay, we implement Iron Key, and we implement a policy that any employee that's going to use a USB port, it has to be an Iron Key USB. So all we do is I help take the list of compliance, just like Sarbanes-Oxley and what I did in the corporate world. There was a list that had to be followed. So I would implement policies, procedures, and IT solutions that followed that list. Did I go to training? No. Did I read? Well, occasionally, like let's say I needed good monitoring software, a firewall logs. Well, we could either hire a service or implement something that could pull the logs in that we could then interpret. So now I'm doing research on a particular solution for a particular issue of compliance. Credit card industry. That's PCI compliance. That's for payment card industry, data security. It's common sense. Once you see the list of what a vendor has to do to in order to guarantee the protection of the credit card info, you now make sure that you're using VLANs or a separate network. That's a virtual LAN. You make sure that those systems that are dealing with the credit card information is a secured connection. You now make sure, because remember, I'm just following a list of compliance, a list of things that particular client has to say they are compliant. Great question in the chat from Barb. Mike, where do you get the list of tasks? Well, here's the thing. The client will provide them to you. I got a client that he received, he had to do a self-assessment for his compliance, and he had a list of 50 questions that he had to answer. There we go. That's our list. A document was sent to one of my biggest clients from who they're actually their broker dealer, and they had like a little book saying, make sure you follow this. This is for your compliance. Well, I take that and interpret it. Overall, you can do your own Googling and say, you know, what FINRA compliance, what are some of the things, or Sarbanes-Oxley. Even the Wikipedia has great information to just the basics of all of these alphabet soups of compliance. All of it is using your IT skills or researching and developing those IT skills to respond to certain items that deal with compliance. If they say the systems have to be encrypted, we have an answer. TrueCrypt. Am I oversimplifying it? Maybe, but you know what? That's what you have to look at. There's something very important involves everything here. In the beginning, you have to define what is in scope for the compliance. A great example for the Sarbanes-Oxley, what made it easier was, okay, we had 200 servers. Did every server have to fall under SOX compliance? No. Only the servers that directly impacted the ability to accurately report the financials for the company. Let me tell you, that now became a subset of 4 servers. Now, of course, I put policies in that would help with all of them, but technically, for SOX compliance, I only had to worry about the 4 servers and how those 4 were secured. How you can't even edit a batch file on one of those servers without approval. A very big term just popped up in the chat, and I want to thank Taco for that. Change control is so important to all of the compliance. No changes can be made without testing, without having a backup plan, without having authorization and approval of the change. Change control is a fundamental, necessary component for everything. And keep that in mind. And you know from shows going way back of how living and breathing, how I had clients where I tried to implement change control, and when they didn't follow it, there were some massive outages. Trying to get people to follow that, it's very difficult. I hope all of this kind of helps, and I know I'm oversimplifying some of it, but it really is that simple. It's common sense that you're following to make sure that every issue you're addressing from the list of items for compliance, that you make sure you're following, you're reporting on, and that you're implementing solutions and controls to guarantee that compliance. So it really doesn't matter what the compliance is. You just take a look at making sure that each one of those steps, so when there is a self-assessment or any assessment or an audit, that you have all of these controls, documentations, policies, procedures, and your IT solutions in place to guarantee the compliance. If you're not willing to put up the work and do that, then that this is not an area you should get involved in. If you are not detail-oriented, you should not get involved in this. Do you have the skill set to do what I'm saying? You don't need to have the answers to everything. You could find them, but you need to have the discipline and that detail orientation that you will make sure that you're documenting everything, that you're helping your client put in place security policies that guarantees their compliance and that their employees are going to sign off and read them. That's what this is all about. I hope that helps. I know we have a whole bunch of other questions that I'm going to get to on the next show. And right now, I want to thank everybody for downloading and staying subscribed to the show. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for continuing to use my Amazon link and for all your purchases. And visit instanthousecall.com. Download the trial version. You won't regret it. I guarantee you'll be back to buy it because it's that impressive. Thank you, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.